Good evening. It's good to see everybody out this evening. If you'd like to turn to the book of Daniel, we're going to be looking at that book in just a moment, in Daniel. The writer of Hebrews tells a lot about faith. Hebrews 11 is one of those great chapters of faith. It lists a lot of great people, Abel and Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Rahab, David, Samson, Jephthah. One of the interesting things about the chapter of faith is that one of the great characters of the Old Testament is not listed. Now, it's not that it was left out on purpose or anything. Of course, I think that Paul, if he was writing Hebrews, said that, you know, time would fail him to talk about everybody else, and he could have gone on and on. And it's not that he slighted Daniel, but you will notice that Daniel's not listed in the chapter, although there could be reference to the whole thing about lions. But still, you would think, as big a character as Daniel was, you know, why is he not listed? And what's interesting about Daniel is that, aside from the book of Daniel, that of course tells the story, there's only two other occasions of which Daniel is listed. One is in the book of Ezekiel, and the interesting part about that is that Ezekiel is contemporary with Daniel. We don't know where they are geographically, but Ezekiel is there in the bondage, and Daniel is there in the bondage, and of course Daniel is going to spend his whole life there. When we get to the final story of Daniel in the lion's den, Daniel's going to be nearly 90 years old. So, you know, he spends his whole time there. But Ezekiel makes the observation that if Noah and Daniel and Job were living at that time, the conditions of the people were so bad that the only people that would have been saved would have been Noah, Daniel, and Job. And it's interesting how that Ezekiel uses the reference of Noah and Job, who have been long gone, and yet he references Daniel as in present states. But anyway, so that's the other occasion that Daniel is listed. And then the only other time is Jesus makes mention of Daniel himself in Matthew and Mark, just on one occasion, talking about the abomination, Matthew 24 and so forth. But when we think about the book of Daniel, immediately some stories come to mind. Immediately we think about, well, the fiery furnace, that's a big story, and then the lion's den, and maybe also the great image. And so there's some great stories in here. In Daniel chapter 2, we find King Nebuchadnezzar. This is, of course, with the children of Israel in bondage. The Babylonians are ruling the world. They have burned Jerusalem, the temple's gone, and King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and the dream troubled him, and not only did it trouble him, he wanted to have an interpretation. So gathered around him were wise men, Chaldeans, and soothsayers and sorcerers and all of that, and he brings all of the wise men in, and he says, okay guys, I've got a problem, and he says, I've had a dream, and I don't know what it means. Well, any good wise man or any good person, you know, in his craft would say, well, that's great, King. Tell me your dream and I will give you the interpretation. King says, I don't know what it's going to be this time. What we're going to do is that you tell me the dream I had, and then I want you to tell the meaning of it. Well, of course, they couldn't do that. And we see that actually they're kind of frustrated because of this. If you look down in verse 10, the Chaldeans answered in the king and said, well, there's not a man on earth who could tell the king's matter. They're good, but they're not that good. Therefore, there's not a man. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such a thing of his magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It's a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Well, that didn't go over well, because the king said, no, I want you to tell me my dream, and I want you to tell me the meaning of it. And they said, we just can't do that. Well, what do you do when you're the king of the greatest power on the earth? You start killing people. And so he started killing the wise men. Verse 13, excuse me. In verse 13, the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men. And they came after Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and they said, we're coming after you. Well, when they found Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, well, Daniel anyway, Daniel said, what do you want? And they explained it to him, and Daniel had a moment of faith, or a great moment of faith, and he said, listen, just tell the king to hold on. I'm going to go home, and we're going to commune about this, and I'll be right back. So Daniel goes home, and he goes in to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and they pray about this thing. That's down in verse 17. Daniel went to his house, made known the decision to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning the secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And then a powerful thing happened. God told Daniel the dream, and he also told him what the meaning of the dream was. Now, that was pretty incredible because, again, an interpretation of the dream is good. Anybody can do that. If you've got a good imagination, you can explain a dream any way you want to. But to be able to tell a man what he dreamed without him telling you is impossible. But God granted, of course, mercy and grace to Daniel and the friends there, and he told him the dream, and Daniel was, of course, very appreciative. So in verse 24, Daniel comes to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men, and he says, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. So he does. Daniel comes in, and he tells the king, okay, I will tell you what your dream is. What you dreamed was this terrible image, and this was great big image that, you know, scared him, you know, half to death. And in verse 31, you were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you. Its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And then he says in verse 34, you watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, broke them into pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found, and the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Well, that would be one of those, you know, you've had those kind of crazy dreams. You know, you wake up and you're thinking, what was that? And you don't really know what it means. It's just weird. You never can run. Why is it that you never can run in a dream? I don't get that. I mean, you can have some, you know, really good tennis shoes on, and it just doesn't matter. You're not going anywhere. But things just don't make sense. And this terrified King Nebuchadnezzar, and it was pretty an awesome dream. Now, we know, of course, that God gave him this dream. So here's this image, got a head of gold and silver and bronze and iron and clay. And this big rock comes and tears it all up, and then it becomes a great mountain. Well, Daniel tells the king, okay, this is what the dream means. That image represents four kingdoms. And he says to King Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. And what this image is representing was a prophecy about the next many, I don't know, 500 or 600 years of what was going to happen. Because what happens is the Babylonian Empire rules the world, and then the Medo-Persians under Darius come and destroy the Babylonians. And then you know who beats the Persians, because they messed up with his father and he didn't like that. So Alexander the Great came as the Greeks, and they annihilated the Persians. And then after a while, the Romans came and took care of the Greeks. And that's what that four image is. The head of gold is Babylon. The chest of silver, was silver, is the Medo-Persian. It was kind of a combination of nations. And then the bronze was Alexander the Great and the Greeks. And, of course, the iron and clay was the Roman Empire. And simply what God has done through Nebuchadnezzar is that he has said that this is what's going to happen in the years to come. And so the Babylonian Empire came, then the Persian, Medo-Persian Empire came, then the Greek came. And it was during the days of the Roman Empire that that weird rock came and destroyed them all and became a great kingdom. That rock, guess what, is you and I. That's the kingdom of God. And what he was saying was that in the days of that fourth kingdom in the Roman Empire, God's going to raise up a kingdom. And that's what he did when he brought Jesus Christ into the world. And boom, we've got the church today. And that's all that was. But the power of this is Daniel having the faith and the courage in the face of death to go to God and said, you know, tell me the dream. And God tells him the dream. And he trusted in the grace of God to deliver him and his friends. And he knew the power of prayer. He knew the power of group prayer. And God delivered it to him. So it's a great story of faith. It's also a great story of the coming years. Sidebar, I think, if I haven't done it yet before, but that's a great study because later in the book of Daniel, he also, in two other places, talks about this same kingdom thing. And it's going to be a ram and a goat. And he explains what this kingdom thing is and how that this was a prophecy of the coming of the kingdom of God and that he does there. So that's there. Then we come to chapter 3, probably one of the more familiar stories in the book of Daniel. We don't know where Daniel is at this time. He's probably on vacation somewhere in the Bahamas or something. I don't know where he's at. But this story centers around Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And for whatever reason, of course, Nebuchadnezzar was kind of smitten with himself. You had to be careful when you're talking about Nebuchadnezzar. You're talking about the man he loves because he thought a lot of himself. But he decides to make this really big statue, probably of himself. It is so big, it's about 90 feet tall. And it's an image that he sets up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And he creates this great image and he says, okay, when this image gets finished, we're going to have a party. We're going to have an opening ceremony. And what's going to happen is that when I build this big old image of 90 feet tall, everybody's going to get together and I've got the orchestra ready. And when those folks start playing that music, everybody is supposed to bow down and worship. Look in Daniel 3 and in verse 5. This is for everybody to be there. Everybody's supposed to be there. You couldn't miss this. In verse 5, Daniel 3, that at the time that you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. And so at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre, in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Because that's what you're supposed to do. Now, we talked about that in our class this morning, but the mode of capital punishment for the Babylonians was that they liked to burn people. That was their mode was the fiery furnace, and they had those things all over the place. And if you disobeyed some law, they just threw you in there. You will notice that the urgency of the law was immediate. Now, it's not hard to figure that out. Here's the golden image. You hear the music, you bow down. If you don't bow down, you're going to be taken off, thrown into the fiery furnace, no ifs, ands, or whatever. You're just going to be put in there, burned up, crisp, and that's all it's going to be. Well, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah have got a problem. They're not going to bow down to this golden image. And so you can imagine how, I don't know, maybe nervous they could have been, but you know, they're standing there and they're part of the official entourage. And so they're in a place of prominence. And they know that music's going to start. And they know what the king said, that if we don't bow down. And so you can see the sea of people, thousands of people. They hear the music starting up, and all of a sudden everybody bows down, and everybody it's like a waves of people falling down to this golden idol, except for three guys. Three men are standing still, and I got to think the guy right over here kneeling is looking up, saying, "Hey, Hananiah, you might want to get down here. Mishael, you better get down here on your knees." I mean, probably they had some friends maybe around there that are bowing down. And they're thinking, have you lost your mind? If you don't get down, are you going to die? And it's a great story of courage. I mean, you think about what it would have taken to stand there and to refuse to do what everybody else is doing. I mean, talk about not going with the crowd. You know, I mean, everybody literally is falling down and worshiping, thousands of people, but three people. And Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are just saying, we're not going to bow down. And they know what the penalty is. And I got to tell you, to think about dying in a fiery pit is not exactly a very pleasant thing to consider. It's just, you just hope you die quick, because it's a terrible way to die. Well, they got caught, of course, and the officials that sort of gave up or gave them up. In verse 12, those tattletales came and said that there are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of Providence of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those are Babylonian names. We'll talk about that in a moment. These men, O king, have not paid due respect to you, due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Now, they changed the rules here, because the rule said, if you don't bow down immediately. Well, they didn't do that immediately, because they actually brought them before King Nebuchadnezzar with a second chance. I think that was kind of interesting, because they said, okay, we're not going to do it immediately. Well, what happens in verse 13? Nebuchadnezzar goes in a rage. He is in a fury. You can see the veins, kind of like Barney Fife. You can see the veins popping out in his throat. And he is just, how dare you do what you're doing? I mean, how dare you even think about not bowing down to my... I mean, he is just incredulous that these men would actually do this thing. And he is just in this fury, and he brought these men. And while we don't have it exactly in the scriptures in verse 14, I'm sure he is yelling at these guys and saying, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image which I set up? Don't you know that I told everybody that when you hear that music, you better bow down? And don't you know that if you don't do this, I'm going to throw you into that fiery furnace? And who is a god who's going to deliver you? Who do you think you are? And he said that a lot louder. But I've got a microphone and I'm not going to do that. But you can just imagine how absolutely furious. His eyes are popping out. His face is red. I mean, this king is going nuts. Because these three Jews think that they can do what they did. And I think it's safe to say that while Nebuchadnezzar is having a cardiac arrest going on over here, the three men are standing there and they're calmly saying to the king. They're just looking at him and saying, well, verse 16. O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known, O king. They're respectful. They are respectful, but let it be known, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the golden image which you have set up. Well, I mean, you know what's coming. Because you know you say that, you're about to die. And I don't know how much more furious Nebuchadnezzar got, but he really just lost it. And he was so mad at these guys. He told the guys in charge of the furnace, you make that furnace 7 times hotter. I don't know what difference that makes. When it's 2,000 degrees, you know, whatever. What is it? 14,000, is that right? But, you know, what difference does it make? But anyway, he did. Because he was so mad at these guys, he just wanted to just nuke them. He just wanted to burn them up immediately. And the fire is actually so hot, if you remember in verse 22, that the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot. The flame of the fire killed the men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's how hot it was. And so they bound them up. Verse 21, they were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and they were cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Gone. Burned like a crisp, died like that just so quick. And the guys who threw him in there, you know. And so Nebuchadnezzar was like, and apparently it's kind of set up. It's not like they, you know, he's able to look in there, and there's an amazing thing. He sees four people walking around in the midst of the fire. And it's like there are four men walking around in the fire. And King Nebuchadnezzar is a little bit confused. In verse 24, he was astonished and he rose in haste and spoke and said to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? He said, yeah, we threw three of them in there. And he said, look, he answered, I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Now, let me sidebar. Nebuchadnezzar was not talking about Jesus Christ. You'll see that. I have seen that sometimes in people talking about, oh, there was Jesus walking with Shadrach, Meshach. That was not Jesus Christ. What he means is that he was the son of a God. He doesn't mean that he doesn't know who Jesus Christ is. He don't even believe in Jesus Christ. He didn't even believe in God for that matter. So just as a side, don't take that in some reference that sometimes people say, well, there was Jesus in the Old Testament walking. No, Jesus never walked around in the fire with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It was God's deliverer that was down there, and I think it's kind of interesting that they're just walking around. Okay, I got to say this. You're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and you're in the fiery furnace walking around. Well, this looks cool. Yeah. Oh, man, that's pretty hot. Yeah. You know, it's like, wow. He's having a conversation. Yeah, you want a hot dog? No. Who brought the marshmallows? No, I should stop. Maybe that's where s'mores came from. But he, in verse 26, said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. And so they walked out of the fire. And the amazing part is, in verse 27, the satraps and the administrators and the governors and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose body the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. I can't even do that grilling. You know, I mean, that's why she doesn't let me grill anymore. I come in, I'm singed and burned and everything. That was a great miracle. But you think about the faith of these guys to stand there and say, we will not fall down and worship this God. And we know we're going to get thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Bring it on. We're not going to serve you, O King. And God delivered them. Now, they didn't know that. They didn't know that God was going to let them come out. As far as they were concerned, they were going to be delivered. Why? Because if they had died in the fire, they would have still been delivered, wouldn't they? If they died in the fire, they would not have been worshiping that golden image. And so no matter what happened, whether they died in the fire or were delivered, God delivered them because of their faith. But I think you can appreciate what an incredible amount of courage it took to stand up and to say, we're not going to do something. I mean, let's talk about it for a moment. What's the big deal? Okay, everybody else is doing it. Nobody, Daniel's not here. Let's just bow down, not make a scene. Okay, we're bowed down. No. They had moral courage to say, no, we're not going to do it, even though they knew the penalty. Many years later, we come to Daniel chapter 6. The kingdom has changed. Nebuchadnezzar is dead. Darius is now, this is the Medo-Persian reign. Belshazzar has died, that whole writing on the wall kind of a thing. And Daniel is he's probably not quite in his 90s, but he's quite aged. But he's been a very good ruler. And I think that there's one thing to be said about Daniel is that he was in the highest office of the government, and he was still a believer and a follower of God. Because there were those who were jealous of him. In verse 1 of Daniel 6, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. And over these, three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account of them so that the king would suffer no loss. And so what happened is that the king had all these 120 satraps, and then he had three people in charge of those, and Daniel was one of those three people. Well, Daniel was a Hebrew. Daniel was the slave. And that really rubbed a lot of people wrong. This foreigner came in here, and he was the guy from the other, regime, the Babylonian regime. And so they kept, but Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and the satraps because an excellent spirit was in him that the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. Man, I'm going to put him in charge of everything. Well, the guys, and the club didn't like that. And so they devised a plan. Now, we've changed regimes. The Medo-Persians had a rule. that whenever a law was passed, it could not be rescinded. It's kind of good and bad. Because whenever a law was enacted, it couldn't be changed because that's just the way they did things. I think there's some value, Blake, you might want to take some notes, but there's some value maybe to that, but then it kind of gets you into some trouble about some other things. So they had a plan and they said, okay, we're going to make a law that cannot be rescinded. Well, the problem is they could not find a parking ticket on this guy. Now you think about it, he's been in Babylon, been a Medo-Persian, he's been a government official for many, many years. They can find nothing to accuse him of anything. And so what do they use against him? His faith. Because what they noticed about Daniel was that every day he would go and pray to the God of Israel. And what he would do is that in Babylon, of course, was kind of north east of where Israel was, and he knew where it was. When he would go to his room and he would open his window in the direction of Jerusalem. Three times a day he would bow down and he would offer prayers to Jerusalem because it wasn't there anymore. I mean, it was burned down. Because he had been doing this since he was a little boy. Great lessons there about teaching young people to pray. He had been doing this since a little boy. And that's what they got him on, because they made a law, and the law says that nobody can give homage to anybody but the king. And they knew that by doing that, they would put him into jeopardy. And so Darius didn't know what they were doing. He signed the decree thinking whatever. And then Daniel knew the decree was signed, knew that if he got caught, he would be thrown into the den of lions. Now, the Babylonians did fiery furnace. The Medo-Persians, they kill people by lions. You know, everybody has their choice of weapons, you know, hanging, shooting, whatever. They did the lions. And so Daniel knew that if he went to his room and did exactly what he's been done since the beginning of whatever, his life, that he would be thrown into the den of lions. And he did. And so they caught him and they came to the king and said, you made a law, you can't rescind it. This guy, Daniel, did that, and so you got to throw him to the den of lions. And so king did. King Darius, you know, made that happen. Of course, he was up all night. He was worried about it. He kind of hated that he did that. Of course, we know what happens is that God delivered Daniel. He sent his angel, closed the mouths of the lions. He's down there hanging out with the lions. And the next morning, Darius comes up and says, hey, you know, where are you? And Daniel says, I am okay. And God sent his angel to shut the lion's mouth. They have not hurt me. And so in verse 23, Daniel 6, that the king was exceedingly glad for him, commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found in him, because he believed in his God. And the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, and their lions overpowered them, broke all their bones and pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. So, you know, not only did these men die, but their children were killed, and also their wives were killed. But in all three of these stories, what have you got? Incredible faith, incredible courage. I mean, these are great stories, because you think about Daniel having that kind of faith to, you know, ask God to tell him, you know, about the dream. And then you got, you know, standing before the fiery furnace, we're not going to bow down. And Daniel saying, listen, I'm going to worship just like I've always done. And it's not going to change. Nothing's going to change. And so you've got great faith. You've got great courage. You've got great love for God. You've got danger. In every story, there's danger. I mean, there's some serious danger. People dying, and you're going to die, and yet there's victory in every story. And yet that's not the common thread in all of these stories. What is the common thread in all of these stories? Here's the real story about Daniel 3, or Daniel 2, Daniel 3, and Daniel 6. None of those stories would have ever happened if Daniel 1 didn't happen. See, we love to talk about Daniel and the lion's den. Kids class in the back, we got lions, you know. We love to talk about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being thrown into the fiery furnace. Great thing. We love to talk about the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw, great lessons that are there. But so often we miss really the point of the focus of the book of Daniel, because you could talk about the dream of Daniel 2. But if Daniel 1 hadn't happened, that would have never come about. The story of the fiery furnace is one of the great stories of the Bible. But without Daniel 1, there's nothing to say. And the faith and the courage of Daniel and Daniel 6 to go ahead and pray like he always has, that wouldn't have happened without Daniel 1. Well, what happened in Daniel 1? Well, let's go back to Daniel 1 and find out what really happened. Because the first battle was the most important battle. The Babylonians came to Jerusalem. They took people away. They did it in a couple of phases. And in 536, they burned the city down, burned the temple. Included in that group of young men were four men by the name of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. This was not how they thought their life was going to turn out. They had plans. They were very blessed young men. As a matter of fact, we find out in verse 4 of Daniel 1 that they were young men in whom there was no blemish. They were good looking. They were gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had an ability to serve in the king's palace and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. These are some really great guys. And I'm sure that they had their life kind of planned for them. I'm sure that they had some plans of marriage and plans of home and all kind of things. But they were wrecked away from their land, wrecked away from their homes, and whatever happened to their families, they have no idea. And so they were just taken away. And they had some important duties to do. In verse 5, the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so at the end of that time they might serve before the king. So they're really kind of in a good place in a way, because instead of being in captivity and being out there making bricks, they're living in the palace. They got nice clothes, and they're under a 3-year training program to learn about how to be a Chaldean or a Babylonian. Well, the first thing they did is they changed their name, and that's significant, because you have to remember, in the Jewish culture, names meant something. Daniel means "my judge is God." So if you know anybody named Daniel, that's what their name means. It's a biblical name. And so Daniel's name glorifies God. Hananiah is a name that means gracious is Jehovah. Again, the significance about Jehovah. Mishael is a name that means "who is he that is God?" It's a statement, not a question. Who is he that is God? Azariah is a name that means "God," or "Jehovah hath helped." And so Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah all were names that glorified God, glorified Jehovah. And they were great names. And they treasured those names. But they came and said, "Okay, your name's got to change." And so they came to Daniel and they said, "Okay, you're going to be Belshazzar." And what that name means is protect his life. It had nothing to do with God. It had to do with the Babylonian gods. Shadrach means command of a coup. So now you're called Shadrach, which means command of Aku. Aku was the moon god of the Babylonian mythology. Meshach is similar to that. Meshach means "who is what Aku is." Again, giving homage to the moon god. And so now you're a Jew walking around with a name that, gives honor to some Babylonian moon god. And then Abednego, and if you wonder why there's a hyphenation there, is because Abednego means that you're a servant of Nebo. And again, all of these names are giving significance and glory to Babylonian gods. So what do you do? And I like to call him Mishael, or Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, because it gives glory. But we know him as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You'll notice kind of even in Scripture, of course, Daniel is never referred to as Belshazzar. But Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are always referred to as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And that's okay, but you think about that. What are you going to do? Well, nothing. And I've told this story before because, you know, my name is Kent, and Mom had this idea that it was four letters and that was all it was going to. My neighbor knew me from the day I was born, and he called me Keith the whole time. And I would say, yes, Mr. Lester. You know, whatever, didn't, you know, no big deal. So that wasn't okay. So you're in a place and they change your name. What's the big deal? Now notice what they're supposed to do in verse 4 at the end of that is that they're going to teach them the language. So now you got to learn the Chaldean language. You can't even speak, you know, Hebrew. You got to learn this foreign language. Is that a big deal? Well, no, it'll help to communicate. Don't have to, you know. So my name has changed, and now I got to study Chaldean. I don't know what this figure thing. Okay, we got that. But then the other part, the latter part of verse 4, is you got to learn the literature of the Chaldeans or the writing of the book. So now you've got to learn everything about the Chaldeans. Well, the thing about their history is it's filled with idolatry and it's filled with all that weird stuff. It is in complete contrast to the law and the Judaizing things. I mean, everything they're learning is completely foreign to what they have grown up knowing. But what do? Nothing. Whatever. Change my name. Teach me the language and give me the literature and whatever. It really doesn't make any difference. But then the day came when the real test came. Verse 8. Now, they didn't make a big deal about the name change. They probably didn't like it. They didn't really make a big deal about the language thing, and they didn't make a big deal about the literature. But when it comes to verse 8, something happened. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs, and the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, good reason to do that, who has appointed your food and drink, for why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. That's a good argument. He's concerned, if we do this, I'm going to get in trouble and lose my head. But Daniel says to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants. And so he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. Kind of sounds like my diet. So what's the big deal? Name change. Language. Okay. Literature. Why the big deal about the food and the wine? Probably, we're not sure, but probably it had to do with, no doubt, in the heathen world, they would eat and drink things that were forbidden of the law of Moses. And Daniel drew a line and said, no, I'm not going to do that. I will not eat of your food, and I will not drink of your wine. And if we assume it was because it was against the law of Moses, he's standing up for the law of Moses and saying that, you know, I will do all these other things, but I won't do this. What he is doing is that, saying, as we like to say, he made a line in the sand and said, all these other things I'll live with, this I will not. But let's stop and think a moment. What did it matter what they ate? What was immoral about eating certain foods or drinking certain? I mean, what was the big deal? The big deal was, it was a big deal to Daniel and his friends. I mean, why make the fuss about the food? Because it mattered to their faith, and their faith mattered. And they said, this is big deal to me. It may not have been to anybody else, but it was a big deal to me. And they made a stand, and they trusted in God. And you'll notice that what Daniel does is that he says to them, you test, and we'll see how it works out. Daniel didn't know how this was going to work out. I think he believed he knew what it was going to do, but it wasn't answered yet. He completely trusted in God. He completely allowed God's will to be done, and he said, listen, we're going to let this thing happen, and we're going to see how this fits out, and if it doesn't, then we'll do whatever. He completely let it to be God's will of how this is going to happen. And that was absolutely key and necessary for everything else that came about. Now, God blessed them, and he put him in good favor. They looked better, and everything was fine. But here's the lesson. The reason that he had the faith to stand before Nebuchadnezzar and said, "Stop killing everybody, let me find out what the dream is because he had already had that battle before, and God had proven victorious about that. And he had said that I'm going to be able to do this. And the reason that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stood before the burning fiery furnace and said, "We will not bow down," is because they had already told the king, "No, we're not going to do that." They drew a line and said, "We're not going to do that." And the reason that Daniel went ahead and prayed like he always did is because he had learned that in that first battle, God is going to be victorious. You have to fight the little battles before you fight the big battles. We wait sometimes and we think that, boy, when that big battle comes, I'm going to be ready for it. Life is filled with daily battles. Most of those battles are small and most of them are hardly noticeable. Some increase in size and they kind of cause some concern, but then the time comes when the mega bomb hits. And something comes up in our life and a huge crisis of faith looms over us. And I'm going to tell you, if a person's not learned how to win the little battles, they will lose that battle. You wouldn't believe how many times that has happened. Witnessed it. Of people who have gone through life not appreciating the value of fighting those little battles, and all of a sudden something huge and major comes up in their lives and they fall apart and they don't know what to do. I mean, why do Christians lose their faith? Why is it that some give up on the Lord? It does not happen overnight. I had a man tell me one time when I had come back from 11 years been gone, and when I was there originally back in 1984, he was the treasurer of the church. I came back 11 years later and he wasn't even faithful, and I went and talked to him and I said, "What's going on?" He said, "Oh, I don't know, it's just my faith. It's kind of like pulling the plug out of the bathtub and it just went out." No, it didn't. The faith doesn't do that. It doesn't just pull a plug and all of a sudden it just go out. It had been dying for a long time. Why does a building just all of a sudden fall down? It looks okay, but all of a sudden it just falls down. It's because it's been decaying inside. Recently, about a couple of months ago, we had some kind of little storm. You know, I got trees out there. And we had a big tree that fell down. Why? Well, come to find out, it looked okay. I mean, it was leaning, you know, but everything out there is leaning, trying to find sunlight. But it looked like a pretty healthy tree. But you know what happened? It didn't have any roots in it. When the storm came through, it grabbed that thing and laid it right down. And you can look at the ball of the roots, and they're about that long. Well, you can't see that. It doesn't happen overnight. And that's the key about faith. If there's not a strong root system, people will fail. A Christian's faith is lost when the heart of the person grows weaker and weaker and weaker. And it's those little signs. And what Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah understood is we've got to win this victory here. Because if we don't get this victory in chapter 1, we're going to be in trouble in chapters 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. Because we've got to fight those little battles. I mean, what are the signs of a dying Christian? You know, just to be honest, there are some things that are just very evident. People who start missing church services. We don't think that's a big deal. We think that, that is a serious thing. I know this COVID thing has just driven us a little bit crazy. But that's one of those little signs that all of a sudden the people they're just lacking an interest in coming to services, and all of a sudden they just fade away and you think, what happened? It didn't happen overnight. It's a sign that is there. And even if people are there, a lack of attentiveness in worship, faith isn't growing. And something comes up in their life and they don't know what to do and they lose their faith. And when there's a lack of prayer life, I mean, examine ourselves. If your prayer life doesn't exist, you don't exist. And your faith is going to get hit hard one day, and it's going to be a very terrible day for you because you don't know how to pray. You don't know where to pray. And if we're not studying the Bible, one of the indicators of our weakening faith is the fact that we don't spend time in the Word of God. And then when the big battle comes, we don't know what to do. Or even the lack of fellowship. Those are just little signs that go on because we're not fighting those little battles. How would you have faced the trials of Daniel and his three men? Friends, I mean, would that food have mattered? Would you have compromised and said, well, it doesn't matter? Do you know what would have happened if you would have said, well, it doesn't matter about the fruit, about the food? You know what would have happened in Daniel 3? When they played the music, you'd bow down. Who's going to notice, right? We're in captivity. Kind of goes back to Joseph that we talked about on Wednesday night. I mean, when Potiphar's wife came after him, I mean, who knew? Who would care? God would. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would have never done what they did if they didn't stand up for something in Daniel 1. I mean, surviving the massacre of the wise men, being accused of disobeying the king and being thrown into the den of lions, learning to fight the little battles first will help you endure the larger battles later. There is an absolute rule that must be understood. If you are not ready to fight today, if you are not ready to fight today, you will lose your faith tomorrow. If you are not ready to fight today, you will lose your faith tomorrow. If you waste your time in playing church today, you will have no faith tomorrow. Today is the day we fight those battles. What you do today will determine how you live tomorrow. It's not like you're going to wake up one day and think, oh, I've got all the strength and the power and the might to do it. You're not going to do it. Because if we don't get Daniel 1 nailed down, forget about the rest of it. Because life is about fighting the little battles so that the bigger battles will be possible to overcome. Doesn't mean it's going to be easy. Because they're not. But you can get through it. I have seen Christians go through things that most of us would never have any possibility of doing. But they did so because they fought the battles in chapter 1. And that's where I want to be. Because I know those days of chapter 2 are coming, and I know those days of chapter 3 are coming, and I know those days of chapter 6 are coming. And I'm working really hard on getting Daniel 1 nailed down, because I know it's coming. And the only way to overcome is to be ready for what it will come. And that's what we get out of Daniel. And while we talk about those stories, they made a conscious decision. May not have been a big deal to a lot of people, but it meant something to them, because they knew if we don't do it today, we're going to be in trouble tomorrow. Jesus fought a little battle so that you and I would not have to fight a bigger battle. I know in some way that's not a fair language to use, because when we talk about what he did on the cross, we're thinking that, well, that wasn't exactly a little battle. And it wasn't, because it was the biggest battle that's ever been fought. Because the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus. But you know why Jesus fought that battle? So you and I wouldn't have to. I don't have to die on the cross, neither do you. I don't have to shed my blood, neither do you. I don't have to worry about death, because he rose from the dead, as we talked about this morning. Jesus fought a battle 2,000 years ago so that today in the year 2020, we don't have to fight that battle. Victory has been overcome. Death has been overcome. The victory of the sting of death, Hades, has been overcome. Heaven is ours. Satan has been defeated. Hell is not for us. I mean, everything's been accomplished because Jesus has done that for us. He fought a battle for us and won so that I don't have to do that. But he wants me to fight my battles. And he wants me to start in Daniel 1 so I can be ready for what's coming. In Romans 6 and verse 3, Paul said, do you not know that as many as were baptized into Christ were baptized into his death? He did that so that I could die. And that's where I've got to serve him to be the kind of person I need to be. Let's fight and be prepared for those battles that are coming. Consider these things as they stand as we sing.